Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, despite strong economic numbers, President Trump's approval rating has lagged in Wisconsin. We'll talk about how the economy has impacted past candidates here in the state and how it's being talked about on the campaign trail this year. First, when you think of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, what comes to mind? Is it the woods and waterfalls and the small towns, the snow, pasties, beer, hunting? And when it comes to the language, is it something like this?
Not bad.
Well, this has got a kick to it, I'll say that. What proof is this, Reuben?
Oh, sorry to say there's not a drop of alcohol in it.
Well, it ain't no pasty pie, but I'll tell you what, I could drink me a few of these without looking up and saying hello, eh? What the heck's that old lady of yours got in here?
Our next guest spent a great deal of time studying UP culture and the language spoken by Upers and how they're looked at by outsiders. Catherine Remlinger is a professor of English at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. She's the author of the book Uper Talk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm excited to talk with you.
Well, we heard that clip from Escanaba in the Moonlight there. Is that a stereotype, or were they fairly close in how they represent the language of the UP?
Well, I would say a little bit of both, partly because, you know, the UP is so large, and even in a small area, not everybody's going to sound alike. So not everybody in the UP sounds that way. A lot of the features that are featured or used in linguistic features in Escanaba and Moonlight are related to more of what people who might be working class or live in rural areas or areas especially that are influenced by Finnish language contact and other immigrant languages from the late 1800s to the early 1900s.
When we talk about the UP dialect, as you say, it does vary from place to place and even person to person. But what are some of the common features that you focus on in the book?
Well, one of the things I focus on is how tourism and media have picked up on, a few significant features or noticeable ones, recognizable ones. And then because the media and tourist souvenirs use those features, we come to think of the dialect as limited to those. So, for example, the A, or that you heard in the clip from Escanaba and Moonlight, the duh for the, or you betcha, or even some of the vowel sounds like we would hear an out and about, for example. So those are some of the features, but not everybody is going to use those or have those in their dialect, and not everybody is going to use them all the time. So context often plays a part of it, too, because we naturally change the way we speak depending on where we are and who we're talking with and what we're talking about.
And that's a key to your book, it seems. Language isn't this fixed thing. It changes, and it says something about our identity, who we are as individuals, who we are as a culture, as a region.
Exactly. And that's part of the reason why Escanaba and Moonlight will use some of those dialect features with their different characters. And if you watch the movie, you'll notice not all characters use them. And the characters who do speak in this stereotypical or iconic Uper talk way, they are the ones featured as being most Uper, right? So the hunters and the people who are local. But the DNR officer, he doesn't have as many of those features as the other characters do. So language, sometimes we're not even aware of it, is our badge of identity and how we use it to identify where we're from and who we are. Could be our religious group or our gender, sexuality, our age, all kinds of different ways.
Over the years, I've heard different ideas of the origins of Uper dialect. Some people have said it's the strong Finnish-American presence there. The A makes people think of Canadian English. But you write that it's really a mix of a lot of different linguistic sources.
Right. And part of that iconic voice, like you hear in Escanaba and Moonlight, is what you would hear more in the northwestern part of the UP because of the prolonged contact with Finnish. Finnish immigrants were the largest group to immigrate, and they were one of the last. But because Finnish isn't related to English, And some other social reasons, like being ostracized for being Finnish, the Finns kept their language longer than many of the other immigrant groups did, 4 and 5 generations, which is rare. Most often, and even today, people will lose their first language during the third generation. The second generation might be bilingual, but because of the contact with Finnish, those features of Finnish, for example, the lack of the TH sounds, like in the, gets da. But a lot of languages other than English don't have that sound. So there was influence by German and Norwegian and Swedish and Cornish English. And we might have gotten A from Cornish English. We might have also gotten it from Anishinaabemowin or Ojibwe, because there's a tag question or that end kind of question in that language too. Also, Canadian French has a similar tag question, hien, that sounds somewhat like A. So we're not quite sure where the A came from, but we do know it's this marker of identity in the UP as well as for some Canadians.
Talking to Catherine Rumlinger about her new book, Upper Talk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Catherine, when did we first come across this idea of the Upper, Upper, as an identity, as a description of someone who lives in this region?
That's interesting, too, because it's relatively new, and partly because the settlement of the UP is relatively recent compared to other parts of the United States, especially the northwestern part. It wasn't until 1842 that copper was discovered there by Douglas Houghton, who was at the time the state geologist for Michigan. Of course, the Anishinaabe had discovered and were using copper and mining it for hundreds, if not thousands of years before that. But European settlement wasn't until the mid-1800s in the northwestern part of the UP. The eastern part had had easier contact because of the access through the St. Lawrence Seaway and the lakes there, contact with French Canadians and missionaries. But part of it is that the UP, the northwestern part especially, wasn't settled to the 1800s. So the idea of what it means to be from a place took some time to develop. And we don't see the word Upper, in fact, being used in media until the 1970s. Surely it existed before then, because words exist in conversation before they get put in print. But the first evidence we can find of that is from the 1970s.
I'm a troll. I'm from Lower Michigan, below the bridge, and spent a lot of time, as many Michiganders do, as a tourist in the Upper Peninsula. Can you talk about, and you were touching on this earlier, how this identity influenced the way the UP promoted itself and have had kind of a mixed feelings about the tourists who came up across the bridge?
Right. So there's, you know, I think anywhere you go, there are probably tensions between insiders and outsiders. But for the UP, you feel it especially strong. And partly that's because the UP has been seen in great distance and physical distance from the center of Michigan in the state capital in Lansing. It's also separated by a body of water, and it wasn't until 1957 that the Mackinac Bridge was built and connected the two. There were ferries that people could travel easily across. And of course, the land is connected to your state, Wisconsin, now, and that's part of it. But there's also economic differences, and also the UP is often left off of maps of Michigan, and that doesn't always sit well with people who are from the Upper Peninsula. Part of it, too, I think, is that there is a lifestyle in some ways different from the Upper Peninsula and the Lower Peninsula, especially with urban areas. But we see this identity being celebrated in tourist souvenirs. So on coffee mugs or on T-shirts, so saying things like, I know how to pronounce sauna, or I have a coffee mug that has different terms for different Youper kinds of things, or I have a magnet that says, I know how to say pasty. It's not pastries, it's not pasties, it's pasties, Youper food of the gods. So telling people how to pronounce things that are local words, for example, are some of the things you would see on tourist souvenirs, and that also promote local identity and what it means to be a Youper.
We're talking about what makes the Upper Peninsula of Michigan what it is with Catherine Remlinger. She's a professor of English at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan, and author of Youper Talk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. You can join the conversation. Do you live in the UP? Do you spend a lot of time there? What sticks out to you about the language and the way of life? Are there some Youperisms that you use regularly? Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR and let us know. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the language and culture of Michigan's Upper Peninsula with Catherine Remlinger. She's a professor of English at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan, which happens to be in the lower part of the state, by the way. She's the author of the book Youper Talk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. You can join the conversation. What comes to mind when you think about the UP? Have you lived there? What do you want people to know about life and language in Michigan's Upper Peninsula? Do you have a favorite Youperism? Tweet us, at CentralTimeWPR. Kate, before we go to our callers, with any regional dialect, there's the question of whether it's going to stick around. We have this mass media, cable TV is the same everywhere. The internet is the same everywhere. Do we see a dialect like the Upper Peninsula variations disappearing over time?
Well, can't say. I always wish I've had a linguistic crystal ball to tell the future of dialects and languages, but that's not going to happen. But what my crystal ball will tell me right now, that language will change, dialects will change. They're changing right now. They have to, because as society changes, language changes. And the people who live in the UP now aren't the people who lived there in the early 1800s or the mid 1900s. And some of the dialects that evolved from language contact with those immigrant languages like German or Finnish, those speakers don't exist anymore. So when people are saying dialects are dying, really what they're hearing is that they're changing. And some linguists would say that regional and local dialects, ways of speaking, are actually getting stronger, but in different ways. So it sounds like they're dying out. And the reason for this would be that how else do we show where we're from or who we are? Language is our badge of identity. Sure, they'll change, but to die completely out, that won't happen. We don't learn how to speak or our dialects from TV or radio. We learn it through people we interact with on a daily basis. And so for that reason alone, we'll never become this one dialect kind of nation.
Let's bring on our callers now. Scott in Oshkosh, hello.
Hello there.
What'd you want to bring up, Scott?
Well, I'm from Texas. I'm an educator. And when I first moved up here to Wisconsin, I noticed there was an excessive use of the word yet, Y-E-T. And it became so prevalent that every time somebody would say the word yet, I would point it out. And grammatically, if I were to write a paper, I would not include so many of the words yet. So I was going to call away with words, but you are the perfect platform.
Okay. And is that like yet instead of the word still? Because I'll do that sometimes, I'm not going to lie. Or is it just yet kind of a floating word?
Both.
Okay. Scott, thanks. You were laughing there, Kate. Is this a Youperism too?
It's not. And in fact, Joe Salmons at University of Wisconsin probably could tell you a lot more about it. So could folks over at the Dictionary of American Regional English that used to be housed at the University of Wisconsin. Yet is a really good example of influence from German. And that's why you hear it a lot where you are in Wisconsin rather than what you probably heard in Texas. I don't know much about it, except that I do know that it's an influence from German because German has the same kind of features. So, for example, I might say, come here yet, which probably to a Texan or me, even it sounds kind of odd, but I kind of get what it means, right? Maybe for a little bit. but I shouldn't say much more about it. I would say contact Joe over in the University of Wisconsin there in Madison.
Thanks for the call, Scott. We'll go now to Deborah in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hi, I'm a Youper, and I don't remember ever using the term A, but when I think of my friends from Ishpeming and Agani, that is the prevalent, is A a word? I mean.
Oh, it is a word, yeah.
Oh, okay. I mean, it should be, even if it's not in the dictionary, but because it's so meaningful, but I always wonder what we sound, or and everybody, I mean, what do we sound like to, like, British people, or what does a foreign language sound like to someone else? But growing up there, it's just an amazing place, and I know you've probably been there, and you know that.
Deborah, thanks. And yeah, I know you went to school in Houghton, Kate, for your undergraduate at Michigan Tech. But talk about that perception, how, say, people who speak the Youper dialect, as Deborah's friends did, when they interact, say, with people from the Lower Peninsula. How do people see those different ways of talking?
Yeah, so I got this idea to do the research when I was actually working on my PhD at Michigan Tech, and I had friends who were local, and we would talk about language and dialects, and I'm originally from Central Ohio, Columbus, and we would talk about how we say things differently. And those friends had moved to Texas for a while, and they said that when they moved to Texas, people thought they were Canadian. And in my interviews with people in the Keweenaw and outlying areas, I asked them that question. So when you've traveled or you've moved to other places, what do people say to you? And most people say, oh, they think we're Canadian. And it's probably that A, but more often it's probably some of the vowel sounds that people hear, and they associate it with sounding Canadian. And in fact, there's another linguist at Grand Valley State University, Will Rankinen, who's studying the vowels. And he has found that the vowel sounds do match more closely to Canadian vowels than what we might think of as Finnish vowels in that kind of way. So that A is part of that, and as well as some of the vowel sounds. You asked about downstate. You know, there's a mix of perceptions, like there might just be anywhere. Some people will think that sounding Youper isn't proper from a linguist standpoint. As long as you're communicating your ideas, there's no such thing as bad English. It's just a different variety of different way of speaking English. So there's a mixed bag of what people will think. But I think that idea that Youpers sound Canadian is probably pretty pervasive.
Let's go back to our callers. Thanks, Deborah. We've got Nicole with us now in Ironwood, Michigan. Nicole, hello.
Oh, hey there. How's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Nicole?
Hey there. Hey, I'm actually born and raised in Ironwood, Michigan, and I used to be, used to is a big word up there. When I moved to Arizona, I was highly embarrassed of our dialect and figured out that there are some words that don't exist anywhere else on the planet, such as pink. And have you ever heard of the word pink before?
Until I read Kate's book, yeah.
All right. Well, so pink. Basically, if you've got a snowbank and you got to take the shovel and, you know, you just pink it down. It's an action word, which can also refer to the hair on your head when you're wearing a hat and it just gets smashed down. That's another definition of the word pink. But I've had to change my dialect a little bit. One of the words also, it's an obvious one, but big. I no longer say big unless I do work on a radio show called the Deer Hunters Roundup once a year. It is a seasonal treat. I'm your camp cook, and we share venison recipes. People call in their deer reports, and yeah, so now I'm acquainted with the language of the dialect, and I get to use that on, you know, basically one of my little career points in life. And
Nicole, yeah, thanks so much for the call. There are parts of Wisconsin where you hear bag and bagel, but talk about the pank a little bit, please, Kate.
Great. So pank is a really interesting word because, like Nicole said, a lot of people believe that that's a unique word to the UP. But what we find is it's only usually known in places where mining was. And what we found is that the word was probably brought in by miners because we find uses of it when miners would talk about panking blasting powder in a hole when they were doing copper mining. But the Dictionary of American Regional English shows that pank is also used in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and oh, now I'm forgetting the other place, but both of the other places are mining regions. Huh. So there's something with that word that was brought in. It's also related to Norwegian and Swedish and Danish banka, which means to pat down or make compact. And that's the same. So it could have been brought in by those people when they immigrated to the UP, because we had people who immigrated from Norway and Sweden and Denmark. So that word is so unique because people claim it as a UP word. And I think it is a UP word, but it is also used in these other places. And it probably came in through the mining.
Nicole, thanks for the call. Time for one more call. I think David in Manawa. David, hi.
Hi. I was born in Marquette. I was raised up near Gwin in the woods. I'm 63. I've been an interstate truck driver my whole life, but I've been accused of being a Canadian so many times. My mother used to always say, "Don't go outside. Don't forget your chuck. Put your chuck on your head." Well, that's stocking cap. And fin scoop. My uncles would make a fin scoop to do the driveway, you know. And I'd say, "Well, I drive my wife nuts because she's from Green Bay. I've been married, but I go into the Upertalk dialect here and now every now and then. And I'll tell you, it just she's like, I crack her ass up, you know, because she's, you know, and I got three sons.
I got to jump in. I'm sorry, David. We're just about out of time. Some final thoughts about Upertalk past and present, or last minute.
Yeah, David's comments, really excellent example of how other languages influence English there, because chook comes from French Canadian took, a knitwinter cap. So it's a really good example. All of these comments that folks made in with their calls is how language varies in the attitudes that we have with them and how our attitudes affect people. And I think that's something to keep in mind when we don't always like how someone says. It's also saying something about them personally, because our language is that badge of identity, this thing that we show who we are and where we're from and who we're connected with, our families, friends, and communities.
Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob. I really enjoyed talking with you and the callers.
Catherine Remlinger is a professor of English at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. We talked to her about her book, Upertalk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Coming up after the news, we'll look at how the economy and the public's perception of it can impact elections, and we'll zero in on Wisconsin 2020. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at how the DNR handles oversight of large farms in Wisconsin and what changes Governor Tony Evers is looking to make. First, strong economic numbers have historically provided a boost to presidential approval ratings and been a plus to incumbents campaigning for re-election. But that hasn't been the case so far for President Trump here in Wisconsin. Despite public optimism about the state of the economy, Trump's approval ratings in the state have largely been neutral since he took office. That's making Wisconsin, which is already expected to be one of the most competitive states in the 2020 elections, even more unpredictable. Craig Gilbert is the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Nice to be with you.
Well, the conventional wisdom, Craig, seems to be good economy is good for an incumbent president seeking re-election. Does it generally, in the past, has it generally panned out that way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't have that many presidential elections to go with, but yes, I mean, when it's been a long, long time, I mean, maybe a century since an incumbent president running for re-election lost despite a good economy, I think there's no question that you'd rather have a good economy than a bad economy if you're an incumbent president.
But things seem to be a little different, as many things are, for incumbent President Donald Trump. What do we see, before we key in on Wisconsin, just big picture, what are we seeing when it comes to President Trump's approval ratings compared to the economy?
Well, we're seeing, you know, relatively good satisfaction in public opinion polling with the economy. We see some positive economic indicators, certainly in terms of growth, in terms of the unemployment rate, in terms of the stock market. So by those kind of conventional measures, you know, the news is pretty positive about the economy. Yet we have a president who's been kind of lingering in negative territory when it comes to his approval ratings very consistently. Since he got elected, I think he's the only president in the history of Gallup polling who has never registered 50% approval. So there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect, certainly in the national polling, and we can talk about Wisconsin, between people's perceptions of the economy and their perceptions of the president's performance.
You dug in closer to Wisconsin numbers. What kind of things did you see with President Trump?
Well, we're lucky enough to have almost 8 years of polling, consistent, regular polling by the same pollster, the Marquette Law School. So when you go back and look at, we can look at the last 5 years of the Obama presidency and the first 2.5 years of the Trump presidency. And what you see is that when Obama was president, when Barack Obama was president, you know, he wasn't ratings of the economy tracked more or less with ratings of the president. They, you know, when he was sometimes overperformed the economy, sometimes he underperformed the economy, but ratings of the two were never that far apart. But under Donald Trump, you know, the perceptions of the economy have gotten a lot rosier, but his approval ratings are lower than President Obama's. So we see this big gap between positive ratings of the economy and negative ratings of the president. We didn't see anything like that under the previous president. He's really, in that sense, kind of underperforming the economy.
You wrote about partisanship and how it affects our polling, and it makes sense. If you're a Republican, you're probably going to rate a Democratic president lower and vice versa. But you're seeing maybe some partisan analysis of the economy. Do I have this right? If someone, say, a Republican and there's a Republican president, they're more likely to rate the economy more highly and maybe vice versa?
Absolutely. I mean, that the evidence is as stunning as you can imagine in Wisconsin, where basically overnight, when Donald Trump became president, Republican appraisals of the economy just went from being pretty negative to extremely positive, and Democratic appraisals of the economy in Wisconsin went from being fairly positive to fairly negative. And it was just a sea change among partisans. Now, because of that, you sort of have to look at independents, who are the least partisan voters, to get kind of a better feel for this. And indeed, what we see among independents is their assessments of the economy did go up, not as dramatically as Republicans, but did go up when Trump became president, but again, kind of lagging approval ratings for President Trump.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the economy and how it factors into presidential polling. President Trump apparently not getting as big a boost from what continues to be a recovering economy. Craig, why? What are some of the ideas out there for why Donald Trump isn't getting this boost?
So there's a lot of potential explanations. So one we've already talked about, which is when people are seeing the president through such a partisan filter, you know, good news on something like the economy is not going to move the numbers as much as it might have in the past, because basically the voters in the other party are always going to be overwhelmingly disapproving of an incumbent president. That's one thing. There's also the question of, you know, you like the economy. Do you credit the president with being responsible for that economy? Do you like his or her economic policies? And then finally, there's whatever your assessments are of the economy. There's kind of your separate assessments of a president on other dimensions. So I think in the case of Donald Trump, we've seen tons of polling data that a lot of voters have qualms about his behavior or his rhetoric or his tone or his style or his personality. And I think it's pretty clear that those things are weighing down whatever positive feelings people have about the economy. They're pushing those numbers in the other direction.
Let's talk about that credit point, because I think some Democrats have tried to make the case, maybe not as much as they might, that, hey, yeah, we're in year 10 of the Obama recovery, trying to say President Trump is just continuing the trend that was already established. Is that this would be hard, I guess, to poll? Is there any kind of indication that people are thinking along those lines?
I think there's some indication that, you know, as you get deeper into a presidential term, people are going to assign more and more responsibility, or they're going to associate the economy more and more with the current incumbent. So in the first year of the Trump presidency, we might have seen more of that. But now it's increasingly kind of his economy. So if you're a Democrat, you may argue, well, he's not really responsible for the economic growth. You may also say, hey, the economy's not doing as well for everybody as we see from indicators like the unemployment rate or the stock market. So you're going to see Democrats argue, don't credit Donald Trump. You're going to see them argue the economy maybe isn't that great for everybody. And you're going to see them make arguments against his specific economic policies, including trade and tariffs, and argue that those have been disruptive to the economy.
You also talked to some strategists on the Republican side. Do they think that President Trump is doing enough to make the case that the economy is good and he has something to do with that?
Yeah, I mean, we saw this during the midterm elections, too. There's always been a feeling among some Republican strategists and some Republican office holders, some Republicans in Congress, that the president, you know, needs to be more disciplined in his messaging, more focused on the economy. They see the tweets and, you know, all the other stuff, the way he expresses himself and what he talks about on any given day, they see those as distractions and as kind of taking away from the economic message. So there's certainly some Republicans who would like to see more of a laser focus on the economy. I think we'll see that at times, but I don't know whether we'll see it consistently or not.
Of course, Craig, we don't know what the economy is going to do between now and next November. While a good economy may not be helping the incumbent president, would a downturn of some sort between now and Election Day potentially hurt the incumbent president?
Absolutely. And I would not go so far as to say that he's not being helped by the economy. I just don't think he's getting, you know, the boost that you might have thought, the degree of help that you might have thought from the economy. But absolutely, the economy matters for him. And I think, you know, if there's any kind of a slowdown, I think that's really problematic for him. I think if the economy continues to perform the way it's performing, it could be the difference between winning and losing for him. It could carry him over the top. But he's in a place where any kind of bad news about the economy, any downturn in the economy, you know, given his negative approval ratings, could be really troublesome.
In a lot of ways, it seems like Donald Trump hasn't followed the usual laws of political gravity and momentum. He was a surprise winner in the Republican primary the first time around. Do you think the ordinary rules apply when we look at polls and try to understand how a president is doing?
Well, I think we got to be careful and cautious. I don't think he's like completely rewritten the laws of politics, but I do think you have to be cautious. Obviously, you have to be cautious about the polling because of what happened last time. And, you know, we don't even know who the Democratic nominee is at this point. And every election is a choice. So as much as Democrats want to make this a referendum on the incumbent, Donald Trump will be trying to make it a choice between him and a Democratic opponent who he will do his utmost to just sort of define in negative terms. And we don't know whether the Democrats are going to help him do that by in terms of who they nominate or not. So none of this tells us who's going to win the election. And I think all of us, you know, kind of look at this with an extra degree of humility because so many people were so wrong about 2016.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you anytime.
Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked with us about President Trump's approval ratings in Wisconsin and why they haven't benefited from strong economic numbers. Coming up, we'll take a look at how Wisconsin handles oversight of large livestock farms in the state and who pays for it. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk with a Democratic lawmaker about the legislature's budget and which of his party's priorities are and aren't included. Now, the number of concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, in the state has risen every year since 2005. That trend is expected to continue. Many of these operations are dairy farms, and with lots of cows comes lots of manure, which can pose a potential risk to state waterways. That's where the State Department of Natural Resources comes in. The agency is responsible for the oversight of these CAFOs. But as our next guest points out, there are lingering questions over the appropriate amount of staffing and funding for the oversight program. Will Cushman is the associate editor at WisContext. You can find his recent piece on CAFO oversight at wiscontext.org. Will, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about the scope of the issue here, how we regulate manure on our big farms in Wisconsin, and what kind of oversight it gets?
Yeah. So this is in the news because of the budget writing process right now. The CAFO oversight. So CAFOs are any farm with 1,000 or more animal units. And so that kind of depends on the type of livestock that's on the farm. It's equal to about 1,000 beef cattle or around 700 milking cows or like hundreds of thousands of broiler chickens, like 125,000 broiler chickens. And these farms, in addition to having a pretty big economic impact individually, have potentially large environmental impacts, especially by way of livestock manure. They have to be able to store up to 6 months of manure on site. So that's an awful lot of manure. If you think about 700 milking cows over the course of 6 months, they produce a lot of manure. So they have to be able to manage that manure in a way that's safe for the workers and the environment locally. And a lot of that is dictated by the DNR.
There are a lot of big questions about how the manure is regulated, the specific practices that have to be used. This budget issue, though, is about how we pay for the DNR to enforce whatever rules have to be in place.
Yeah, and that's been an issue for a while. The DNR would like to have a ratio of field staff. So those are the people who go out and do site visits when a CAFO is proposing a new operation or their permit needs to be renewed. They do site visits if there's enforcement that needs to take place, if there's been a complaint. They do a lot of other stuff as well related to enforcement of CAFO practices. And they want to have a field staff ratio of 20 to 1. So that's each field staff should only be responsible for about 20 CAFOs. And since 2011, that ratio has been higher. Each field staff has been responsible for up to closer to 30 CAFOs in some years. But yeah, they've been really struggling with staffing. Staffing turnover has been an issue in the last couple of years. But right now, there's talk of being able to raising fees on CAFO permits or at reallocating the current fees to be able to pay for that field staff and their enforcement, basically to get more field staff out there and in conducting enforcement more often.
Before we get into those two different plans, is there, at a practical level, is there a backlog, I guess, of DNR not being able to quite keep up with enforcement and inspection?
Yeah, that is precisely the issue. There's been a backlog. So CAFOs are allowed to operate under an expired license. Each license has a five-year term, but because there's such a backlog, staff are not able to keep up with the re-permitting process. If a CAFO's permit expires after 5 years, they can still operate and just wait for DNR to get to their case and issue them a new permit or not. Usually it's reissued. But yeah, this backlog, 2 years ago, there was an audit of the program and like a third of CAFOs were operating under expired permits. Now it's a little under a quarter of CAFOs. Still not good. Their goal is for that to be under 15%. And they say that they just need more staff to be able to get to that goal.
Talking to Will Cushman from WisContext about how Wisconsin regulates and inspects its largest livestock farms and how we pay as a state for those inspections. How do we pay right now, Will? Where does that money come from?
The vast majority, we're talking over 98% of the funding for just the staff alone, comes from just a general budget, so Wisconsin taxpayers. And that's a little different from a lot of regulated entities in the state, like municipal, wastewater, other financial regulations are often paid for in bulk by the people or the entities that are being regulated. That's not the case with CAFOs. They pay for right now, there's an annual permit fee of $345. $95 from that goes toward the CAFO oversight program. So that's like 1.2% of staffing was paid for by the regulated entities, the CAFOs, in the last fiscal year. That doesn't even count other kind of administrative costs. And so the proposals right now, there's two. One has been floated by Republicans, which would just reallocate all of that $345 annual permit fee toward the CAFO oversight program that would give it quite a bit more money, but still it would be like 4% of the program would be paid for by CAFOs. Governor Evers has proposed increasing fees quite a bit, but it would still be just about 15% of the cost of the program would be paid for by CAFOs.
So that plan is in the governor's budget proposal. Then lawmakers went this other way. We actually talked to a couple of lawmakers who wanted to do that. They saw the need for more DNR inspectors. They're saying, let's just divert the $300 and some fee. More of that goes toward this particular use.
Exactly. Yeah, right now it's just $95 of that, and the rest of it goes toward the general fund for the state. So yeah, they want to reallocate all of that toward the program.
Now, that part doesn't seem too controversial, but Governor Evers talking about a fee increase, there's been some back and forth on that. Can you lay out the arguments you've heard pro and con?
Yes. And these are not insignificant fee increase proposals. He proposed increasing fees to $660 annually. That's up from $345 annually. He also proposed a new permit fee. So once you are approved for a permit of over $3,000, and that would be paid every 5 years. So when an issue is up for renewal, it would also have to be paid. So they're not insignificant new fees. And there has been quite a bit of pushback from industry groups. There was a lobby group for large dairy CAFOs that formed right after Governor Evers' budget proposal was published. They say that we've had 5 years of really bad milk prices. It's affecting all farms. This is not a good time to increase fees for a subset of those farms. On the other hand, you have conservation and environmental groups who say that these fees are, while not insignificant, these proposed fees would just be pretty small for an operation that is dealing with $5 to $10 million of annual revenue, or has upwards of 2,000, 5,000, 9,000 cattle on site. It's a pretty small price to pay per cow per year. And they also point to the fact that CAFOs don't pay for the vast majority of the regulatory program.
As a sidebar, there are some things that these large livestock farms, these CAFOs, do to monitor themselves, right? The DNR counts on them to do different kinds of reporting, and they're looking to make that work a little more smoothly. What's going on?
Yeah, so after this audit from 2016, which pointed to a whole lot of problems with the program, the DNR did move a lot of the permitting process online, which they say has made it quite a bit more efficient. Generally makes sense to me. And they also, the self-oversight that they ask the CAFOs to do for themselves, it's often done on this annual calendar that's published and put out called the CAFO calendar. And so all CAFOs can get this calendar, and it tells you on this day, these are the aspects of your operation that you need to inspect, and you have to record what, like how deep the or how far the manure was from the top of the storage structure, water lines you have to inspect, see if, and report any problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But most of that oversight is done by CAFOs. They did make it for the first time this year in 2019 a PDF calendar that CAFOs can electronically enter all of that data, which would hopefully make it easier for the DNR to look through it and make sure that there's no compliance issues. That was a major problem before. It was that the DNR would take in all these paper calendars from CAFOs and then just basically let them sit and not know whether or not a CAFO was doing a good job of assessing its own compliance.
Well, we'll watch how this shakes out in the budget. Can you wrap up by reminding us what's at stake? Why are people so worried about the amount of manure collected at these CAFOs?
Yeah, what's at stake is really water quality, both surface water, so that would be our lakes, rivers, and streams and wetlands, and then also groundwater, which is where a lot of drinking water comes from, especially in rural Wisconsin. There was a study in Kewaunee County recently where a microbiologist from the USDA found that quite a bit of the rural wells out there, like the drinking water wells at people's homes, quite a bit of those wells were contaminated with bovine contamination, so derived basically from manure and also from humans, which comes by way of basically, for the most part, old septic tanks, but also not like septic tanks that aren't functioning properly. But yeah, it's a major issue. There's a current study going on in Southwest Wisconsin as well, as I'm sure a lot of listeners are aware. There's three counties in Southwest Wisconsin that are also, the wells there are being tested to better understand contamination, where it is, how often wells are being contaminated, and what the source of that contamination is.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Will Cushman is the associate editor at WisContext. You can find his recent piece on CAFO oversight at wiscontext.org. Many people, especially those of us who are in front of microphones every day, know that it's important to make sure they're turned off before we start chatting. Ronald Reagan learned that lesson the hard way in 1984 when he didn't realize his mic was already on as he prepared for a scheduled radio address.
I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Reagan was not the first or last public figure to be caught on a live mic. As technology develops in the new world of social media, there are even more things to worry about. For example, a local politician in Pakistan wanted his constituents to be able to watch a press conference he was giving, so he decided to use Facebook Live. Sounds like a great idea, except the feed had an extra feature that the regional minister didn't mean to use, a filter that superimposed cat ears and whiskers on his face, and they stayed there for the entire broadcast. His party prides itself on being pioneers of social media in Pakistan, so many found it even funnier. As is often the best response in a case like this, the politician took it in stride with humor. CNN reported that he told the agency France Presse, "I wasn't the only one. Two officials sitting along me were also hit by the cat filter." Here on the radio, just so you know, I always have the cat filter on, but it's radio. You can't see it. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.